I don't know how many of you have been watching Downton Abbey on Masterpiece Theater on PBS. I'll confess that I am utterly hooked on this show. And I will also confess that I am much more interested in the lives of the servants downstairs than I am in their rich employers upstairs. Downton Abbey, for anybody who's not tuned into this, is a British parlor drama about a grand old house in Yorkshire and its resident count and countess. As these things go, the life of the family of the Earl of Grantham seems to amount to little more than marrying daughters off to suitable heirs, wondering and worrying about when the money will run out, and deciding what to wear to dinner each evening. In its stilted way, the family calmly bumps from one minor scandal to the next, all the while appearing as calm and regal as a swan crossing a reflecting pool. Meanwhile, we lucky viewers get a chance to look downstairs and see what's really going on in this grand old house. And there we see a host of servants going about their various jobs attending to the family upstairs. Valets and footmen and ladies' maids and chauffeurs and kitchen maids aid a butler and a housekeeper and a cook. As the stately swan crosses the pool, its feet below the surface paddle quite vigorously. Nothing would happen in this royal world if the servants did not loyally give their best to this stiff upper-class family. The show is worth watching just for the witty remarks and the cutting glances. But the reason that I'm far more interested in the servants on Downton Abbey than their employers is that the servants seem to be the ones who are far freer to be themselves than their superiors. The irony, which is planned, I suspect, of a show like Downton Abbey is that it shows us how those who can resist temptation are the most resilient. Aside from the meager personal possessions the servants have, the splendid house in which they live and work belongs entirely to someone else. The Turkish carpets, the Wedgwood china, the Devonshire crystal all belong to the count and the countess. As the servants move between the spare, utilitarian lower level of the house to its sumptuously furnished upper rooms, they carry with them a certain freedom that allows them to resist temptation all around. It is not that each servant might not dream of being better off or even of being rich, but their training has equipped them well to resist the temptation of luxury and ease. I wonder, would we resist it ourselves so well? If your life is like mine, something demands your attention almost every waking moment. If your life is like mine, even your dreams are crowded with the demands of daily living, crowded with anxiety and bewilderment, that our waking lives and our dreaming lives are often so overly full should come as no surprise to any of us. We live in a culture that is chronically anxious, and the way that it copes with its chronic anxiety is by doing more, buying more, and wanting more. We Americans are simply drowning in our stuff. We are being suffocated by our own schedules. And we are being robbed of our mental health by the world that we have created. And if we do not find a way to resist at least some of the temptations of this life, at least partially, we will never find the resiliency we need to live truly happy lives. A story is told of Jesus of Nazareth from early in his ministry, in which he is tempted by a devil. I suspect it will be common to many of you. In this imaginative myth, the devil finds Jesus in the wilderness after he has been there fasting and praying for 40 days. One interpretation of this story is that Jesus has so retreated far from society and is so physically hungry after his long fast that he conjures up the devil in his own mind. No matter, we have all been plagued by such a hallucination at one time or other in our own lives. In this story, the devil tries to trick Jesus by building up his ego. The devil flatters Jesus and asks him to turn the stones into bread so that he might eat his fill, and Jesus refuses. Then the devil takes him to the top of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem and tries to convince him to jump off, saying that the angels will surely catch him because he is so very important. Again, Jesus refuses. Lastly, the devil takes Jesus to a high mountain and offers to give him all of the lands around it if only he will worship him. And a third time, Jesus refuses. Even in his weakened state, Jesus can see that the devil's temptations are empty. Even after 40 days of fasting, Jesus can see that the devil has no real power to make these temptations come true. It is a mirage, after all. But I wonder if this mirage would be so obvious to us. Are we not asked daily to turn stones into bread? Asked to turn the work of our hands into sustenance? Are we not asked daily to throw ourselves off of high buildings? Asked to throw ourselves completely into our work or child rearing or our volunteerism? Are we not asked daily to worship false idols? Asked to bow down to cars and houses and retirement plans and expensive vacations? And what happens to us if we never give any of these things up? What does life do to us if we do imagine that we can have it all? What perilous place might we find ourselves in if we allow devils to convince us that we are terribly important and terribly powerful? Worse yet, what if these devils trick us into believing that we actually deserve all of the things that we have? What, in turn, might allow us to turn our backs on these temptations? In a sermon delivered at Marquand Chapel at Yale Divinity School, Maggie Don says, "If temptation were all about blatant wrongdoing, it would be far easier to avoid. Most people do not want to commit crimes or indulge in dissolute or destructive behavior. But what about seeing a way to achieve something good by a shortcut that is just marginally blurring the true integrity of a person, or allowing a gift to seem altruistic when it masks personal pride?" She goes on, "True temptation lies in our capacity to justify the means of an end and to nudge ourselves into tiny, incremental compromises. Overcoming temptation, then, for us as well as Jesus, she says, is not about obeying rules. It's about identifying our underlying motives and about the choices that are set before us, and about taking the ones that make us fully human in honest service to our calling." This coming Tuesday is Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, the day before Lent begins. I find it ironic, though not surprising, that American culture makes much more of the one day of Mardi Gras than it makes of the 40 days of Lent that follow it. We do like a party, and boy, do we like excess. People who are not the slightest bit religious will be out in droves on Tuesday night to drink and dance and get those coveted beads, you know the ones. Bar owners know that it will be the best Tuesday night of the year. And lest I sound like some wet blanket, I like a party just as well as the next person, even on a Tuesday night. But when people celebrate Mardi Gras with no intention of changing their lives in the slightest for the following 40 days of Lent, it makes you wonder why this Tuesday is any different than all the others. Lent asks us to give up something. In classic terms, it is meant to give up something physical like chocolate or alcohol or cigarettes. And more recently, observers of Lent have broadened their renunciation to include things like television and shopping. But the giving up of something needs to lead us to a deeper consciousness, or it will just be for show. Giving up something needs to result in our being able to resist unhealthy things in general, not just miserably going without something until Easter Sunday arrives. Let us look back on the story that is told about Jesus. It is precisely the 40 days of clarity in the wilderness that allow Jesus to refuse the devil's temptation. It is because Jesus has been practicing the art of giving things up that he is able to resist ease, luxury, and security. If he had never taken the time to get away, never deprived himself of anything that he wanted, or never taken an unflinching personal inventory, Jesus would have fallen for all of the devil's promises, and he would have been destroyed. The spiritual life demands that we open our eyes and our ears. It demands that we are honest with ourselves. It requires us to see the world as it is and to know our place in it. Each time we give up something, we say to the hyper-consumer world that we live in, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Each time we give up something, we reassert that relationships are more important than stuff. Each time we give up something, we build up our resistance to the larger temptations of life. The well-to-do Crowley family that inhabits the enormous house on Downton Abbey is so immersed in its own worldliness that it cannot see the excesses of its living, even when the Crowley way of life is threatened by the changing times. It is as if the members of this family have so little experience in the real world that they are simply incapable of saving their own skins. Over and over, they are rescued by one or another income source, but each time the drama moves them closer and closer to a cliff. Part of the show's tension has us imagine what everyone in the house might do if the fortunes were to fail and the house were to close. And in this regard, I am certain that the servants would be far more resilient than their employers. Of course, Downton Abbey represents the different sides of human nature. We may envy the wealthy their luxury, but we secretly hope that we would be as skillful and as resourceful as the servants. We hope that we would be as loyal and true as they are. We would like to think of ourselves as more capable of seeing the world as it is, rather than as a fantasy. We know that the best things in life do not come easily and do not come without sacrifice. We know that it is in giving something up that we will be most able to resist temptation. So let us keep treading that staircase between the real world and the imagined one, knowing that the grounding in one will allow us to resist temptation in the other. Let us live with open eyes and with open hearts. So be it. Amen.